Welcome to another episode of Health Policy Essentials, the podcast that explores key policy issues for hospitals that provide safety net care. I am Jason Prey, Vice President of Legislative Affairs at America's Essential Hospitals. And with the recent passage of the Republican reconciliation, with $1 trillion of cuts to Medicaid, today we're going to have a timely discussion on how essential hospitals deal with the rising amounts of uncompensated care. And joining us for this conversation today, we have Ryan Loke, the Chief Health Policy Officer at Grady Health System in Atlanta. And we are blessed to have two folks from Harris Health in Houston, Texas. We have King Hillier, Senior Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations, and Julie Rabbit Torkey, who's the Administrative Director at Harris Health System, as I mentioned before. So again, I probably will repeat this a bunch of times, but $1 trillion in cuts to Medicaid and uncompensated care has always been a big thing for those members of America's essential hospitals. So kind of a lot of questions that may sound leading questions, but the leading is pretty obvious. So Ryan, kick off with you. Uncompensated care has always been a problem with essential hospitals and the margins that our hospitals operate on. So what are some of the challenges that you've experienced when discussing hospitals' uncompensated care and the various financial challenges with legislators? And are there strategies that have been successful that you've employed to address these challenges?
Yeah, no, Jay, it's a good question. And thanks for having us on today. It's a timely conversation, given what passed over the summer. And as we're looking towards the future, how we're reacting and planning to what's coming down the pike. But specific to your question about uncompensated care, unfortunately, uncompensated care, like a lot of things in hospital and healthcare world, gets a definition that can often be confused with other terms. You've got things, obviously, like uncompensated care that can get confused with things like community benefit and charity care and underinsured and what goes in the financial assistance policy. And then what are the inputs to those things? And when you start, you know, people don't use the same set of definitions across the industry. And oftentimes you can be talking about uncompensated care, whether that be charges or a percent of Medicare or things like that. It's just very confusing because we don't like to use a standard set of terms when we talk about these things. One of the most successful things that we found when talking about the challenge that we face with uncompensated care here is distilling it down to the human impact side of it, and really identifying a specific patient count and a specific dollar value associated with that patient count utilizing services that there is no direct reimbursement for. So at any given point, I can go and meet with a staffer on the Hill or go talk to folks out in the community, and I can tell you, hey, in any given year, there are 61,000 people that come to Grady that don't have access to insurance at one point during their time, during their visit at Grady. And those 61,000 people account for about $300 million worth of costs that there is no direct reimbursement for from a payer, from the government, or any other entity. Obviously, there are things like Medicaid DSH and other aspects that there is some level of reimbursement for a percentage of those costs for, but there is no direct reimbursement. But what we found to be most successful is really distilling this down to the human factor at its simplest level. 61,000 people, the number of folks who are uninsured that come to Grady every single year, and those 61,000 people account for about $300 million worth of costs that there is no direct reimbursement for.
Yeah, that's not insignificant, obviously. Mm-hmm. King, just you've been at this a long time and talking with decision makers and legislators in Texas. Anything to share from your perspective on the successful way to talk about this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really expressing what the true burden is, in particular in a state like Texas, where, of course, we did not expand Medicaid under the ACA. Texas has one of the highest rates of uninsured. Houston, Harris County has approximately 1.2 million uninsured. We care for about a little under 300,000 unduplicated patients a year. I think also discussing just the magnitude, 43% of our patient volume is uninsured. So we are heavily reliant upon Medicaid supplementals as well as local property taxes. Local property taxes account for approximately a third of our budget. And then Medicaid supplementals pick up approximately another third. So we have, in particular, a third of our budget, almost $800 million a year, that is in jeopardy because of the big, beautiful bill. And we were very, very concerned and expressing that concern to our members in Congress, to our members both. We're very fortunate to have Congressman Dan Crenshaw and Lizzie Fletcher on the Energy and Commerce Committee, and they have really, truly stepped up for us. And Congressman Crenshaw frequently calls LBJ his hospital. So there's some ownership that he does feel towards that, and I think that's why you see some of his leadership role in that. So I guess in a nutshell, it's just really explaining our story. We are a little bit unique to most even most safety net hospitals with the high levels of uninsured.
Well, let's stay with your story for a minute. And, you know, I think back to the point, you know, $1 trillion cut from Medicaid, and from an analysis we've done at America's Essential Hospitals, that's an increase of about $443 billion with a B of uncompensated care over the next 10 years. And, you know, on average, an essential hospital has an operating margin of negative 9%. So, you know, again, back to your story, you know, what is your system? Like, how are they going to feel the effects? Where are they going to feel the effects? Kind of what type of planning are you all looking at?
Well, actually, being a non-expansion state, we were sort of spared some of the deeper cuts that we were initially looking at. Initially, before the final bill passage, we were looking at the potential of a $600 to $700 million loss. But that has been mitigated, once again, due to the fact that we're not a non-expansion state. Now, what the impact of that's going to be whenever we move from the ACR to 110% of Medicare, that's still a wait and see. So there may be a shift. There may not. We're getting mixed messages from our consultants at this stage of the game. But more concerning, though, is the lack of inaction on the Medicaid disproportionate share front. We're looking at Texas alone would lose $800 million in DISH. We anticipate approximately a $70 to $80 million reduction in our DISH payments if Congress does not act. And that is significant dollars. Even though we do have a $2.4 billion budget in 2024, still $70, $80 million there, that's a real cut. I will also say the other impact that we're seeing right now is, and we're doing research on it, so I don't have any hard numbers, but we're seeing the impact of the chilling effect of our immigrant population. Approximately 20, 25% of our patients are immigrants. And we're starting to see reductions in volumes, a reluctance to come in to see their physician. So that all has all sorts of ripple effects into the emergency center, et cetera, and a higher morbidity, mortality rate, and acuity rates in our facilities, which will have, once again, impact the cost of delivery of care.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but just, you know, one point, a lot of folks in DC, you know, talk about whether the government should pay for immigrant care. Sure, that's a good conversation to have, I guess, but you know, our hospitals, essential hospitals, all have a mission to care for all. So if you walk through our doors, we care for you, and there's a cost to that. So not trying to necessarily engage in that debate about federal government paying for who or not paying for or different groups, but our hospitals are providing that care. And this is a big part of the uncompensated care that is going to grow. So thank you for pointing that out. And yeah, go ahead, Ryan.
No, Jay, I was going to say it's an interesting piece about the immigrant side of things. You know, Georgia not being a border state, we still see a very significant amount of folks who are not U.S. citizens or undocumented coming into Grady's ER every single day. And under EMTALA, we're obligated to provide that care. And there is a little bit of reimbursement under emergency Medicaid, but if they have to get admitted or if they have to go and get, you know, time in the outpatient clinic, so on and so forth, that stuff is not reimbursed and further kind of exacerbates this uncompensated care challenge we've been talking about.
Julie, we've left you out of the conversation so far, and I apologize. But, you know, from your point of view, how does kind of this growing uncompensated care, even the current level of uncompensated care, kind of impact the hospital's operating margins and like your ability to keep facilities open or provide services or kind of, you know, the whole menu of things that our hospitals do?
Right. So at Harris Health, and King has given you some good details, but you know, to further talk about, we'll talk about the payer mix. So for Harris Health, our payer mix of Medicaid and uninsured and underinsured is at 63% right now. This means that we don't have the ability to offset uncompensated care with, you know, favorable commercial and managed care payment contracts. So that's actually quite meaningful for hospitals like us with a payer mix like that. And as King said, you know, approximately 60-ish percent of our funds that we do get are based on the state Medicaid supplemental programs and then the ad valorem taxes. So we're very, very beholden to, if you will, or held to any activity that's happening to either increase or decrease those funds. You know, everything that everybody said so far is all on point. I think the one thing that I would say right now, we also see the threats to the 340B program. With the recent HRSA notice of the rebate pilot. And we really don't know yet what the direction that the feds will take concerning the program overall, you know, in terms of, you know, reforming the program. But for Harris Health, the 340B program is mission critical. It gives us the ability to provide a wide range of medicines to our patients. And we dispense almost 2 million prescriptions per year. That's a lot of prescriptions. So the cost savings for us is very material in the hundreds of millions of dollars. And if we had to pay those costs at full price, I think we wouldn't be able to, really to sustain the expanse of care and the number of patients that we're able to cover today. So, and yeah, to summarize, short answer, uncompensated care absolutely has a direct effect on our ability to provide the care needed in our community, in our county.
And I'll see if anyone has a specific experience with this at your hospitals. You may not, but we're hearing from some of our members that they may not be closing services or cutting off services yet or closing down wings or buildings. But there's already been a few examples where one of our hospitals was going to take over another facility that was really struggling, and they're just not able to do that now because of the cuts and because of the they know the uncompensated care that's coming in. So, you know, I think that's the first step in this, because as probably Julie knows more than most, you don't just wait for the cuts to hit in 2028. You got to start planning now. So there's going to be a lot more of that news coming out. But, you know, King or Ryan, if you want to add anything there.
Well, I would also say, we've been talking about the Medicaid supplementals and directed payments, but also that's out there that's going to have a dramatic effect in the Houston market is the lack of inaction to maintain the enhanced premium tax credits under the ACA marketplace. At Harris Health, we did something quite unique, and we were one of the first in the country, where we identified patients that were under the premium subsidy and that were currently uninsured, and we insured them. What we found is out of that bucket of about 25 to 30,000 patients that we gained coverage on, a large number did leave our system because they're now insured and went into the Texas Medical Center facilities. Those facilities have received over $200 million in reimbursements from the ACA marketplace. Harris Health, after paying $12 million in premiums, collected over $80 million in ACA marketplace payments to those patients that stayed with us. So what's going to happen in our market, we have now increased or decreased the number of uninsured in the community. And now we could potentially see that go into the opposite direction and increase the uninsured. So it's going to be increased uncompensated care for all. It's going to be increased premiums for all, not only those that are in the marketplace, but also in the premiums that Harris Health is paying for our employees will go up.
I'm here in DC and I'm not at a hospital, but how do our hospitals adapt and make sure they keep providing services and seeing the patients that they need to? Like what strategies are involved? And maybe a question for Julie, but I'm kind of open it to anybody.
Well, I guess for me, I think the one thing that I wanted to stress again is, you know, at Harris Health, we're committed to providing quality care. And it worries me, you know, because you're now putting downward pressure, you know, on the system. And at some point, you know, how does that balance and that really what we're striving for to be the highest quality of care, how does that get affected? So that's something that really concerns me here for the future, given what King just described, you know.
I'll add on to that, though. We are fortunate in Houston and Harris County in that our commissioner's court is very supportive of us. Right now, we levy about $800 million in local property taxes to subsidize the budget. And what we did, you know, working on the local level, we explained to our county commissioners what is going on in D.C. and what's going on in Austin, Texas. And they did see the need for us to have a 8% tax increase. So we were able to raise our rate by what we call in Texas the voter approval rate and not the no new net revenue rate. So the local level is trying to help us absorb these cuts and stuff. So, and we're communicating that. Lizzie Fletcher did a great job in energy and commerce the other day. I mean, she said taxpayers, the local taxpayers picked up the difference. Now, how much further can we go with the local taxpayers? I think that we're at that limit. But we're, once again, we are fortunate in that we have that support thus far.
Jay, I think one of the things that Julie and King have both kind of hit on, but big picture from Grady's perspective and back to your question about, you know, how do essential hospitals look at this? Unfortunately, the conversation about HR1, about uncompensated care, 340B, the expiration of the subsidies, all of these things make it pretty close to impossible for any health system, not just an essential hospital, but especially essential hospitals, to plan for the future. If we're looking into 2026 without some level of certainty around Medicaid DSH, around the subsidies, you know, when we're looking at investment out in the community and whether that be, you know, growing new clinics or growing campuses or doing, you know, mobile stuff or investments in technology and telehealth, we can't confidently make those investments without that certainty. And oftentimes when Congress sits and twiddles their thumbs, no disrespect to Congress, until the end of the calendar year, and we're looking at setting a budget in October, November for the future year and then successive years, you know, it makes it really, really difficult to plan. And oftentimes you can't just go and say, hey, you know, on December 31st, Congress made these decisions, we're ready to rock and roll. We can't on a, you know, flip of a switch turn around and say, all right, you know, January 1, we want to make these investments. Those things require thoughtful time planning that unfortunately we're kind of at the whim of Congress to be able to make those decisions. So it just makes it much more difficult to plan as we're staring a bunch of these kind of issues straight in the face right now.
And that might be the more difficult part of this advocacy, I think, at least with Congress. I mean, it's much easier to say, hey, we shut down this service or this facility because of the cuts. But when you go and talk to them and say, well, we're no longer going to do these five things because of the cuts, it's harder to, like, I don't know, can't touch it, feel it, see it, because it never actually came to be.
Yeah.
So it's almost like it's not a real thing.
Yep.
Which is frustrating. All right, we're getting close to time. I like to keep these kind of tight. So, you know, Medicaid shortfall is already a thing. And I just think people out there, when we talk about not just uncompensated care, but the cuts, like Medicaid was already coming up short to paying for what care actually costs. So a little bit of a pivot. I wouldn't call that a misconception. I think that's just people maybe don't understand, but King, we'll turn to you first, but what are the common misconceptions or disconnects when you talk about uncompensated care with federal legislators, state legislators, kind of anybody, county folks, whomever?
I think the largest misconception from a Texas perspective is that there is this mindset in Austin and Washington, D.C. that Medicare and Medicaid covers everything. And there's also a misconception that because there are abusers of certain programs that we all know, they throw us all into the same basket, if you will, the bad apples. So, you know, it's once again, really working and, you know, frequent visits, open communication with board members, with your CEO, myself, bringing Julie and others, and just really just pounding the pavement.
Yeah.
And having hard and fast examples. I mean, that's where it was really interesting watching some of our members in our delegation, both in Austin and Washington, where we first started and we just had this continual information flow, and you build a trust bond, and that they know that what you're telling is good. It's good to take it to, as I say, take it to the bank.
Ryan, kind of building off that, I think one challenge is there's a lot of different kind of avenues of financial support that offset uncompensated care or go towards safety net hospitals like our members and like your hospital. Like, can you just chat for a little bit about those, how those sources help our hospitals just stay open? And of course, you know, no margin, no mission. So
yeah, no, it's a good point. And back to King's earlier point, another common misconception that we hear from staffers, from local folks, people out in the community, is that, oh, if you're poor, you can be on Medicaid. And in 40 states across the country, that may be true in the expansion states, but the 10 states that have not yet expanded Medicaid, that's false. And so if you've got somebody who has a substance use issue or is chronically homeless or is just down on their luck and, you know, they're a single individual, they're not eligible for Medicaid in non-expansion states. And all there is no reimbursement for their costs when they come to the hospital or where they go anywhere else out in the community. But JD, your question about, you know, what sources exist to offset some of the costs that exist, I want to emphasize some. There is no silver bullet magic wand that covers all of uncompensated care costs. Obviously, you've got Medicaid DSH. We've talked a little bit about that potentially expiring here, I guess, in 6 days by the time that we film this. Hopefully going to get extended. But again, the conversation every single time makes it hard to plan around these things. That Medicaid DSH provides such a significant lifeline to essential hospitals, and particularly essential hospitals in non-expansion states, to be able to recover at least a little bit of the uncompensated care that we see. We've also talked a lot about Medicaid supplemental payments and the strategies that CMS, through multiple administrations, have laid out for health systems and physician groups and others to be able to take advantage of, supplemental payment and what's called directed payment programs to be able to bridge some of the gap that exists between what Medicaid does pay and what Medicare pays or potentially what the commercial payers pay. Over the last 4 or 5 years or so that Grady has partnered with the state of Georgia to deploy some of these supplemental payment programs, we've been able to see a direct relationship between those supplemental payment dollars coming to Grady and our investment back into the community. We've been able to open up 5 new, what we call neighborhood health clinics, which are just large primary care campuses out in places that don't have access to those clinics or those services today. We've been able to start investing in, you know, getting off of this campus from an acute care perspective. We're opening up a freestanding emergency department down in Union City and south of Atlanta. Grady's not unique in that. You know, most essential hospitals across the country have utilized some level of directed payment or supplemental payment strategy to be able to recover costs and make investments as part of their nonprofit mission. But unfortunately, as we've talked about a lot today, those cuts are looming as well, beginning in 2028, taking 10% off the payment amount each year, potentially. So going back to kind of my theme throughout this whole conversation, very difficult to plan when these deadlines are sort of there, but may not be there. And unfortunately, it makes it difficult to plan.
A lot of work ahead for all of us.
Yep.
So I want to thank Julie, thanks King, thanks Ryan for joining today. And I just kind of want to end, you know, uncompensated care is not just made up of charity care for uninsured individuals. It's also for individuals who are insured, but or underinsured maybe, and they can't afford their medical bills. And when you look at the 2024 essential data report put out by our association, you know, much of the care that our hospitals provide to these vulnerable patients is uncompensated or under reimbursed care. In 2022 alone, our members, who make up only 5% of the hospitals in the country, provided almost $8 billion in charity care, which would represent about 28% of all of the charity care in the country. That includes about just under $650 million in charity care for individuals that had insurance but cannot afford their medical bills. So this isn't just talking about those who are uninsured, as the point's been made, but I think that's important to talk about before we kind of log off here. And that's it for today. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Health Policy Essentials. Visit essentialhospitals.org to read more about late-breaking issues pertinent to hospitals at the center of our nation's healthcare safety net.